Andrew DeVeagle and Steve Duenes of the New York Times interviewed by Jared Spool. Recorded from the studios of User Interface Engineering, December 11th, 2007. Welcome. I'm Brian Christensen, producer of UIE Podcasts. This week, our Jared Spool interviews Andrew DeVeagle and Steve Duenes of the New York Times. Andrew is the editor at the multimedia desk, and Steve is the director at the graphics desk. A great deal of the visual content you see in the New York Times goes through them. Jared asked them for a behind-the-scenes look at the processes and inspiration that goes into their work. The duo will also be presenting Engaging an Audience Using Out-of-the-Box Thinking to Create Great Designs at our Web App Summit this March in Coronado, California. We're excited, and if you'd like to join us, check out webappsummit.com for more information. And now, here's Jared.
Welcome, everybody. I have on the line with me today Andrew DeVeagle and Steve Duenes. They are from the New York Times, and they're going to be speaking at the UIE Web App Summit, and they're going to be talking about the journalistic process that the New York Times uses for doing some of their interactive graphics, which is one of my favorite parts of the New York Times. I'm always excited to open up my online edition and see what fascinating graphics have been put together. One of the first ones that really attracted my attention was the home run analyzer that you guys put together, which was this interactive way to look at the different home run records over time and how fast people sort of achieved it. And of course, this was all in the light of the Barry Bonds story. And did he actually achieve something at a faster rate than, let's say, Hank Aaron or Willie Mays? In talking to you guys about this before the recording, one of the things that I learned about this was that this is an ongoing data-driven application. This wasn't just a one-time thing. Is that correct?
Well, it started out as a one-time thing. And then, you know, obviously people continued to hit home runs. And so I think originally the chart was limited to just the top 20 home run hitters. Or those who had hit maybe just 500 home runs. And as the season progressed, you know, others were making it onto the list. I think Alex Rodriguez made it onto the list and Jim Thome. And so there was sort of a need to keep the chart updated. And Matt Erickson here quickly tweaked it, wrote a script, and that allowed the chart to kind of update itself. We ran into some problems with that, you know, later in the season, but ultimately that worked out pretty well.
So this is something where you didn't really imagine it would be this automatically updated thing, but as time went on, that was a function you added in.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the interactive graphics we produce are, you know, kind of one-offs, meaning they go up, they tell the story, you know, they're sort of available to readers for a few days, and then, you know, ultimately they're always available. You know, people can Google these things and find them, but they're not really heavily promoted on the site anymore. And so like a newspaper story that sort of comes up and then goes away, that some of our interactives do the same. And that's kind of how we were thinking of this. Barry Bonds was approaching the all-time record, and your description is right, that the chart really looks at the connection between the age of the home run hitter and the number of home runs they hit. And we thought it would just be a one-time thing, but, you know, obviously as the season progressed, the producers wanted to continue to link to it, so there was a need to amend it.
Now, how many of these types of interactive multimedia experiences do you guys create in a month, would you say?
Well, it depends on the month.
Formal news month, I guess.
Yeah.
Or do these more on slow news month? I mean, is this something you guys do as a background to other activities, or is this really, how's that work?
We are working on them in the background, and I think you know, Andrew's group actually is, maybe Andrew's better, you know, can answer this question better than I can. We're tied a little more tightly to the daily news. And you want to?
And maybe one clarification. Steve and I, we collaborate very frequently on projects, and Steve leads a relatively large group of graphic and visual journalists, and I lead a group of multimedia journalists that look at sort of either on the audio side of things or on the multimedia side of storytelling, as well as, you know, other components that we do with multimedia. So when news arise, the opportunity to collaborate together is when we deliver these sort of high-impact multimedia stories that you've mentioned with, that we can talk in a little bit about in the future or in this podcast about, such as the DNA exonerees or the debate analyzer, where we usually team up together to produce a package. So, I mean, in response to your question, Jared, on how frequent, I mean, it really is depending on the news events as well as what's happening with the overall site. My team is also involved in, you know, creating and developing sort of templates or tools that allow a larger number of producers to be able to tell their stories in a multimedia approach.
So how does that process work? Like, let's take the debate analyzer, because that's a very cool application. It basically allowed people to – why don't you describe, I'm not going to do it justice,
right,
how the analyzer works.
And we'll the debate analyzer, I mean, it is what it sounds. I mean, it's a way to sort of interact with the transcript during the debates. In it, you can get side-by-side display of video as well as the transcripts from the debates. And we've done about, I believe, 7 of these since the end of September. And within the transcript, you can also randomly access certain points of the transcript via a list of major topics. So you can actually scroll through, rewind through the video as well as the transcripts. So that part of the tab was developed on my desk by a guy named Gabriel Dance, one of our producers. The second tab allowed folks to be able to actually type in specific words or phrases to search within the transcripts. The entire piece, I mean, the second tab, generally, it was produced by Tom Jackson, but that overall piece was a collaboration from a number of folks from Steve's desk. So the user interface, the flow of the information, and all the back-end programming was a collaborative effort.
The majority of the effort on that piece was definitely Andrew's crew, specifically the transcript analyzer, and Tom's programming work on that was pretty extraordinary. But I think part of the inspiration for that piece comes from some of the print graphics that the graphics desk has done in the past. You know, the one that I'm thinking of is one that we've done for a couple of years that analyzes the State of the Union address. So what we've done is, you know, we choose maybe 20 words, you know, from Iraq to Afghanistan to taxes to immigration, and count the number of times that the president mentions those words in the speech. And then, you know, because it's the same speech, you have kind of a consistent set of data, and you can compare one year's speech to the next year's. And what you start to notice are these patterns emerge. There are years when, you know, he's very keen to talk about Social Security and healthcare, and, you know, his focus is clearly on domestic issues. And so you see, you know, those numbers, the number of times those words get used, those numbers are high. And then, you know, the next year, depending on kind of what happens in the country or what his policy focus is, the emphasis will switch to, you know, Afghanistan or Iraq, words that have to do with foreign policy. And so, you know, over the course of a presidency, you see, you know, these patterns build up. And it's very interesting just to look at a number of years and see how things change, how the emphasis of the speech changes. And with a tool that Andrew's team has built, that analysis occurs basically on deadline. You can look at the emphasis that different presidential candidates are striking during a debate. It's not quite the same thing, but the concept is very similar.
And hopefully the goals a bit, I mean, as we collect more and more and record and transcribe each of the debates through the coming election, and we can also scan them over time and be able to distinguish any patterns over one debate over another as the time progresses. So that's the hope of what we'll ultimately get with the debate analyzer.
So basically the debate analyzer, to some extent, is a toolkit that you put together that you can now just sort of plug debate content into. How much customizing do you do for a given debate?
There really wouldn't be any customization. Otherwise, I mean, once the platform's built out, we don't necessarily customize per debate because we want that consistency throughout across the over time. I mean, there's a certain amount of...
So, for example, the YouTube debates where the questions were coming from these sort of YouTube folks versus from a news moderator.
Right.
Did you have to change for that? Or was that something you anticipated from the beginning? Or was it something that just happened to plug in nicely? Or
We just sort of, as with any news stories that we try to cover and present online, is we basically respond to how a story unfolds. So that just happens to be the way to...
And I also think that the structure that they set up, you know, with a transcript that describes a moderator, describes a questioner, is kind of broad enough and flexible enough so that whoever is asking the question, if it's a news person or if it's coming via YouTube, the structure that they set up still holds up. You know, it still is able to accommodate, you know, that change without them modifying the interface.
Mm-hmm. Just to be clear, it's not an easy matter of just plugging it in. For each debate, there is a certain amount of legwork to be had to make this happen. So,
can you say a little bit more?
Optimization on the front end. I'm sorry?
Can you say a little bit more about what that legwork is?
Well, I mean, recording the video itself and being able to get the transcripts time-coded at the same instance. I mean, there's a lot of fine-tuning to make the entire piece work the way, as smoothly as it does now every time we run these. So it's not a simple plug-and-play situation.
Right. So you've got a fair amount of work. Is there work that crops up in the moment that you weren't able to plan for as much? Or does, you know, at this point, given that there have been, for at least the 2008 elections, you know, 700,000 debates so far, and we're not even in 2008 yet, has it gotten to the point where you know all the steps and the steps are really very straightforward? It's just a bunch of legwork that has to go into it.
And I can say that's pretty accurate. There's certainly a lot of legwork in terms of basically making it, you know, producing within our template. And just to be clear, I mean, the development on the front end was tremendous. I mean, to be able to create a video roll and make it respond directly to a transcript and make it searchable, I mean, those are pretty heavy lifting programming work from Tom and Gabe on the front end. So with the knowledge of what type of content we were going to expect and what type of content we were going to search on, I mean, that's part of the challenge that we had to sort of think about in the front end before we even used it on the on this particular series of debates.
Now, you also mentioned another project that you're particularly proud of.
The DNA Exonerated.
Can you talk a little bit about the story behind that and sort of how that project came about?
For that particular story, I mean, this was... Obviously, it's not an entirely new story in terms of the DNA Exonerated. You know, a lot of it comes from the Innocence Project in terms of, you know, the history of the Exonerated being recognized through DNA. That so it was part of a story that was reported over a year. And as the news desk came to us in terms of thinking about how to present the story in a multimedia fashion, our desk was pretty much deployed and started thinking about how to successfully put together some visual presentation and seamlessly compel our viewers, you know, with the voice and the heart of the story and supported by the facts and the numbers of the data. And that's where, you know, the challenge came to be.
So this is a story about people who've been sentenced to prison for crimes that subsequently DNA has exonerated them.
That's right. That's
and
right.
So this Explorer tool that you put together basically talks about each of these people and talks about, in many ways, sort of what their life was like as they sort of realized that they're now no longer in prison.
That's right. And we focused the story on their life after prison rather than, you know, the actual circumstances, and that was the focus of the overall piece. The one-year reporting that was done ahead of time was really looking at one specific exonerated, Jeffrey. And what we wanted to do was sort of surface the body of work or basically surface the other stories and allowing the voices of those men to be heard as well, literally. So part of the goal of our presentation was to present smaller bites, smaller sound clips on the front end so that people can actually hear the voices of the exonerated. And as you drill down, as you go into the interactive, there's ways to explore both the voice of the stories, the voice of the men, as well as, you know, sort the different numbers and the different data within the interactive. Relatively difficult to explain without actually showing some visuals of how that's done, but I encourage the folks to get on nytimes.com to check it out.
Right, right. And again, we'll provide a link in the show notes for the interactive piece. What's interesting to me about this particular thing is the way that you combined text and visuals and the audio component, and how you let people basically explore all of those things.
And again, I mean, I think that was also the handiwork of Mr. Tom Jackson on my desk in terms of how to produce that within a Flash component. But it was a collaborative effort of working with the rest of my desk, worked very closely with Steve's desk on, you know, thinking about how to sort of present that information, as well as working with the Coy Vince Design Group in terms of, you know, some of the usability aspects of, you know, presenting a complex story at this fashion with multiple, you know, as you recognize, with multiple data points, with multiple audio files. And certainly, you know, we look at that and we kind of think about other applications that we've used to be able to surface, you know, individual audio tracks, for instance. And, you know, you might see a hint of a sort of an iTunes kind of feel, but it's obviously something that we try to, you know, fit within the context of the story.
Right. So I guess that brings me to a question about how you guys are sort of inspired by other things that are built by folks. I mean, do you guys get together and say, hey, look at how iTunes does this particular way that they represent how audio is playing, or look at how this tool does this? I mean, do you spend a lot of time sort of exploring and talking about other applications that are not necessarily related to reporting the news, but could have design elements in them that you could take advantage of?
I don't know how much we talk about it. We talk a little bit about it, but I think, you know, both of our groups explore different outlets. We're part of the culture, and so, you know, iPod is kind of ubiquitous, and it's hard not to be influenced in some way by some of that interface design. You know, for our group, inspirations come from, you know, from a variety of sources. You know, things that have gone on in the graphics department in the past, what other news organizations, you know, are doing now, and what they've done historically. You know, a great source for us has always been, you know, the old Fortune magazines from the 1940s, to look back at what the graphics desk that magazine did at the time. It's really, you know, kind of amazing, the quality of the information graphics that they were producing. And it extends into even advertising. I can think of a Microsoft campaign that they ran in magazines, where it was a photograph, and there was kind of like a child's drawing over the top of the photograph.
Right.
And what I guess the reader was supposed to do was, you know, assume that Microsoft products would allow you to kind of imagine, you know, different possibilities beyond just the reality of what's in the photo. And to apply that kind of a construct in kind of a weird way, actually, there was an apartment building on the Upper East Side that exploded about a year and a half ago. And so the thing that we wanted to do for readers as graphic journalists was to show them what existed before the apartment building was gone. And so we had a photograph of the rubble, and we made a very simple line drawing on top of that that represented what the structure looked like before. And we were able to annotate that to say, you know, what existed on what floor. You know, obviously the information and tone and everything is very different, but the inspiration in terms of, you know, how it's constructed, something very basic, is inspired by an advertisement. I don't know, Andrew, do you want to jump in?
We're all users of, you know, certain amount of technology. I mean, from, you know, Apple products to, you know, even Google products. I mean, there's certainly inspirations that would come about just by general use of what we do. But we also like to think that there's a certain amount of, you know, expertise on both of our desks, as well as Coy's design desk, that kind of would want to challenge some of that norm and just sort of say, you know what, maybe this will work. You know, it's somewhat new, but there's ways to explore it and try to make it easier for the user. So, you know, we get inspired, but we also would like to think that, you know, we like to try to think that we can break some new ground, some of our interactives.
I think that's true. I do think that even within the building, you know, we don't sit with Andrew's group and we don't sit with Koi's group, and there are other people who are doing different kinds of design work in the building. And sometimes you see something that they do and it influences what you're doing, and you sort of build on that, and then they see that and they sort of build on it a little bit more. And so there is plenty of kind of internal inspiration going on as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm consistently blown away with how clever you guys are. The stuff you do. That recently, you had an interactive graphic about RV trailers.
Was that the one that
a long time ago?
Through it, you can see that through the trailer.
Yeah. No, I don't think it was a long time
ago. That was about a year and a half.
It was about a year and a half ago.
Oh, it was a year and a half ago. I just discovered it. I don't know how I found it. In this particular interactive, you have this trailer that you can move this magnifying glass over. You drag the magnifying glass. It shows you what's inside the trailer. And again, it's one of these things where you could easily have just done a side-by-side with an inside and an outside, but there's something just compelling about dragging this magnifying glass around. And what I really like is in the kitchen, the burners seem to actually burn it.
That's right. A rare little bit of cheese from the graphics desk. We try to keep things straightforward, but you know, the designer on that project, who is really a terrific designer, Sean Carter, was working from a piece that, I mean, the piece came from the print section of the Week in Review, and Bill Marsh, who's our graphics editor over there, kind of had this idea to, he noticed the trend that RVs were just getting huge, and he thought it might be fun to make a comparison to can barely recall exactly what the specific comparison was, just because it was so long, seems like it was so long ago, but
2006,
that's like years ago.
Many projects before.
But
compared,
you know,
to
so,
a 58 Stanley.
Right. One of those little silver bubbles.
Right.
And so, you know, Bill gathered the information, and then Frank O'Connell, who's a great 3D illustrator on our desk, put the drawings together. And, you know, in print, obviously, there's no magnifying glass application. And so they approached it a little more conventionally. And Sean made the leap to kind of think about what it was that we were trying to show, that it was interesting to show both the exterior and give readers access to the interior, and that was what he came up with.
It's gorgeous. It's seamless in terms of how it works. The images just flow. You really do believe that you're sort of looking into this, you're somehow looking through the screen into this vehicle, when in fact, you know, it's just really fast flash graphics, but it just shows how you can take something very simple and do some amazing stuff with it. So it's very exciting that you're going to be talking about this in March, and I'm going to encourage our listeners to attend our summit so they can hear you talk more about this. But I want to thank you guys for taking time today to talk to us a little bit about your inspiration and how this stuff becomes soup, and we look forward to hearing more from you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jared.
Thank you, Jared.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can comment on this and other episodes, as well as find more UIE podcasts at uie.com/audio. Don't forget, if you'd like to hear more from Andrew DeVeagle and Steve Duenes, be sure to join us for their presentation at our Web App Summit, March 26th through 28th, 2008, in sunny Coronado, California. You won't want to miss it. Learn more at webappsummit.com. That's all for this week. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.